This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. There's been a lot of coverage in the news recently about the big estates and how the individuals who passed away did or didn't have an estate plan. And of course, I'm sure a lot of you have been reading about Tony Soprano's estate and how much of it is going to get eaten up by estate taxes because of his lack of estate planning. And the Wall Street Journal has recently run a series of articles on how certain types of estate plans and their setups can be a challenge for their heirs. And that's why today's topic, we're going to talk about simplify. Do not make it complicated for either your surviving spouse or your heirs.
You know, Jim, certain estates really do require a certain amount of complicated estate planning. You know, we've been talking about limited partnerships, family limited partnerships. You talked about last week with Louis Mazzello. And sometimes you just can't get away from having a complicated estate plan. And I was thinking also today you're going to have Ruben Garcia, who's the local district director of the U.S. Small Business Administration, talking about building small businesses. And for families that do have a business, sometimes the estate planning and succession planning can get quite complicated. But that doesn't mean you have to make it even more complicated than it really needs to be. You can simplify the process for the people that you love.
Yeah, and even, Kathleen, if you have a large estate, maybe your assets are in real estate, it's a family business, and if it's sizable, you're going to have a little bit more complicated estate. But you can have a manual that's put aside. I was meeting with one of our large clients, and it's rather substantial assets, and we are now revising their estate to add a corporate trustee as a backup. But one of the things that we've done in this particular case, they have their estate documents in a safety deposit box at the bank, and they also have some valuable items there. They have one of their children who has a key or an access to that if something happens to both of them, because they do a lot of traveling. And then also they've sent a written record to the other children saying, hey, if certain things are not in the estate after we're gone, we just want to let you know this was what was on the safety deposit box. But they also have those records at home. So they have like a little file. It's like a little plastic container. All the estate planning documents, they always try to keep recent statements. The one thing they've done, they've consolidated everything. So everything they have outside bank accounts are with our firm, but they also have their recent statements there. Everything is in a file folder, things about properties that they own outside their residence. So all of their children and the successor trustee are going to know exactly what needs to be done. And there's a plan in order. If one spouse passes away, we have a plan that takes care of that. We've done some things to eliminate the estate taxes on this estate. So there are a lot of things that you can do, even though it's quite complex. Just being organized and simplify can make a major difference.
Jim, you're so right. I was just thinking about one of our clients who came in recently, whose husband recently passed away, and he had stuff tucked away everywhere. This poor widow was running all over the place taking care of things. I mean, just to give our clients an idea of how easy it is to make things more complicated than they need to be, this woman was dealing with an annuity contract, a life insurance policy. He was concerned about banks going under, so he had the FDIC insured maximum at 5 different banks. He managed some of his own assets at a personal brokerage account. He had a couple accounts with us. He had precious metals stored in safety deposit boxes at 3 different banks. She had to deal with managing her Social Security widow's benefits, military retirement widow's benefits, pension survivor benefits. He had 3 different limited partnership arrangements, and just to make things more complicated, he had some paper stock certificates that had to be turned into electronic form so they could be traded. Now, she was lucky because all the stock certificates used the same transfer agent. But, Jim, that's 20 organizations or 20 times she has to go through the process of providing paperwork, information, death certificates, filling out forms, updating the trust document. I mean, That's really pretty overwhelming for someone who's just lost a spouse to go through that and then moving to all these different places and trying to gather up information.
You know, you think, okay, I've put everything in order. I got a living trust. I have a will. I have ways that I want my estate to be disposed. And then, as you just talked about, an annuity contract, life insurance, 5 different bank accounts, 3 bullion storage brokerage accounts, pension benefits, partnerships, paper certificates for stocks. Actually, you can still do this, but he actually had the stock certificates. I don't know why that was the case. But you know what? I think it happens. This individual passed away in his 90s. In fact, just after his 92nd birthday. So I would imagine, Kathleen, over a long period of time, saving, putting money aside, all of a sudden you start getting all these assets and you forget about all these things. And at the time, it made a lot of sense. Well, okay, I don't want to have everything in one bank in case they go under. So maybe 5 bank accounts. You kind of wonder if you had that much in a bank account, really at almost zero interest, what was going on there, the partnerships. But these are the kind of things that when you think you put your affairs in order, this is the stuff that is going to be a nightmare for your surviving spouse, not to mention your heirs. And especially as in this case, where the husband handled all the financial transactions, I can imagine, because I saw you the other day, as you guys were trying to meet and sort this out, as I passed by the window, a look of almost frustration and just like overwhelmingness with the task at hand.
Her first challenge, Jim, was just trying to figure out where everything was, because he had stuff tucked away everywhere. And so she's just been spending the last few months just trying to get a handle on what does she have? And then what she's doing now that she's sort of got a handle on what she has is simplifying the structure so that she's not dealing with 20 different institutions. So she's consolidating a lot of her accounts down to one and all that sort of thing. But still, I mean, yes, it's been very hard for her. She's been blessed with a friend who's been willing to step up and help her deal with a lot of this paperwork and mess. But yes, she's been very overwhelmed by the amount of hoops she's had to jump through and paperwork she's had to complete. And just trying to keep a handle on all these moving parts has been really challenging for her.
Yeah, I remember the story in The Friend. It's kind of touching. These two gentlemen had been lifelong friends going back for a very, very long time. And it was almost like he had a sense, this particular individual passed away from a heart condition, but he almost had a sense that something was happening or he wasn't feeling right. And he had asked his friend about 6 months before he passed away, and he had that conversation. He said, look, you come from a financial background. If something ever happens to me, you know, please help my wife. And she's fortunate that he stepped up to the plate because that was his best friend. But a lot of people don't have best friends that can step into that situation. It reminds me, Kathleen, once early on in my financial planning career, it was in the early 80s, I took on these clients. 2 of them, husband and wife, had been Holocaust victims. They had survived. And of course, when the Nazis came to power, they seized a lot of assets. They were of Jewish faith, and a lot of assets were seized. Now, they were fortunate that they had some assets from their parents that were outside the country, and they were safe, and they brought them here. But one of the things they did here, and maybe it's just the mindset of going through a traumatic experience like that, but they had, just like this individual you're talking about here, multiple bank accounts, multiple investment accounts, multiple certificates. And I remember when the husband passed away, that was back in the 80s when the exemption was only $600,000 on an estate. So a husband and wife with a trust could pass away $1.2 million. And we were trying to gather the assets to split the trust in two. And it was almost like a nightmare. I remember she came in with several shoeboxes worth of statements. And it was like sorting through these statements, trying to figure out as best we could, where these assets, where these bank accounts were. And then, of course, several years later, after her husband passed away, she eventually passed away. And Kathleen, I can remember 2 or 3 years after she passed away, dealing with her children, where they'd come up, hey, I just got a statement from something. What is this? And we'd find other assets. That's the situation you definitely don't want to be.
Right. I mean, everyone likes to get, you know, an extra inheritance, but it does tend to make this situation, you know, sort of drag out. And like we've been talking about, it makes it really hard for the surviving spouse. And Jim, I think what we're trying to say here is that it seems like every family has one person, one spouse usually, who's the money person. and one person who's really not the money person, who really couldn't care less about the finances of the family. And if you're in that situation where you're the money person and you have a spouse who's not a money person, you really have to think and ask yourself, okay, I have gold stored at 6 different banks and 6 different safety deposit boxes. You have to imagine and visualize your spouse. Let's just say it's your wife. Your wife going to each of these 6 different banks, going through the checking against a list process, going to have the coins or whatever it is assayed, going to a bullion dealer, a coin dealer, and selling these coins. If you cannot visualize her going through all those steps, you know it's not going to happen. And so all the saving you've been doing is just not going to have the effect that you wanted. So basically what you need to start thinking about doing is, what unintentional barriers am I putting up for my heirs and my spouse in terms of how I've organized my assets? So just try to think about how you can make things easier for your spouse or your heirs to deal with once something happens to you.
And it's not just that. It's not just making it easier, but it's also finding a backup, because we've been involved in several situations where the husband was the main financial person in the family, tried to get his wife involved, tried to get him, you know, why don't you listen to the podcast, listen to Lifetime Income, because, you know, someday, especially in this case where there's, I think it's 8 years difference between the two of them, it's more likely, and especially with longevity on his wife's side, his wife is going to end up being the survivor. But Kathleen, she has absolutely no interest in finances. She loves playing bridge. She loves playing golf. She loves socializing. Those are the things that are important, being with her grandchildren when she can. That's what she likes. You know, sitting, going over financial statements, watching the market, she could care less. And so in this particular case, we've set up a position where we've got a corporate trustee that's going to come in, that's going to handle this. We're going to be handling the investment side of it, working with the corporate trustee, so she can carry on and do what she likes doing best. She doesn't want to deal with the market. She doesn't want to deal with accountants, lawyers, all those kind of things. So there's another aspect. It's not just simplifying, but also maybe putting your estate in a situation that if you are the main financial person and then all of a sudden take yourself out of the picture, ask yourself this one question. If something happens to me, could my surviving spouse make the investment decisions that I'm making, handle the finances that I'm making, or deal with all the complications of the market, understand that market, or even worse, a situation where you maybe have kids that are in need that you want to protect a surviving spouse from spousal abuse? I mean, think about that for a minute. These are the issues that you're starting to see more and more starting to crop up. We're seeing elder abuse. And as in the case of the Soprano star, where he had this huge estate with the family and nothing more than a will. Now that's going to go through estate taxes. It's going to be tied up in the probate courts. This is something you really don't want to do.
Jim, you know, some estates really do require some complicated planning, and these structures we talked about, like generation skipping trusts and limited partnerships and charitable bequests, life insurance policies to cover estate taxes. Some people set up their estates with strings attached so that certain people can't inherit money until they reach a certain level of education or they, you know, achieve so many birthdays. And so I think we've talked about simplifying the asset structure. It's not always possible to simplify the estate structure, which is why I think if you're the money person in the family, you need to find, like Jim was saying, another person outside the family. Maybe it is a family member, like a child or a brother or a sister or a friend or a CPA or an attorney, someone besides you who knows what's going on. Don't have to know amounts necessarily, but need to know who are the contact people, what are all the moving parts, and what are your wishes and desires. Just that someone besides you has some kind of handle on what's going on with the finances.
You know, this brings to mind, Kathleen, one of the articles that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, which is one of my favorite publications to read, because they have a section on financial planning and wealth management, which is definitely worth reading. But there was an article, and I'm thinking of this one in particular, When Dad Secretly Amasses a Fortune, which came out on the 22nd of this week. This very frugal and modest man had accumulated $100 million by the time of his death. But when he died, his family was absolutely shocked by the amount of money he saved, but even more shocked by how he chose to pass it on. It also reminds me of an article, gosh, this was back in the 90s when everybody was going to be a stock-picking star, and there was this woman who had worked. She was a librarian, Kathleen, but in the process of being a librarian, she used to do this research on stocks, and she lived very, very modestly, lived in an apartment in New York City, didn't own a home, didn't own a townhouse. And I think the value of her estate was like $30 or $40 million. I mean, she just picked great, great blue chip stocks, from drug stocks to Coca-Cola. And she built this massive estate. And a lot of times, that's the way a lot of people are. They're very frugal. They're not ostentatious in their money. And you would have no idea. I have met several people, we have them as clients, that when you meet them in person, you would never know the amount of wealth that they have because they don't display it. And this is something that I think is surprising sometimes for the heirs. I can't tell you the number of times I've sat across the table when somebody's passed on, and all of a sudden, when we have to go through either the assets or the estate taxes, sometimes they're shocked because of things that weren't done. I mean, we've had a lot of cases that have been brought to us after mom and dad have passed on. They weren't our clients, where children that listen to the show come in and say, you know, this is what I got. What do I do? And a lot of times this can be very, very challenging, which is one of the reasons why not only do you want to have a backup system, but you also want to simplify. Kathleen, why don't you talk about the one article about the thumb drive, which I thought was brilliant.
We actually have a client who did this. We have a client whose father recently passed away, and he decided after his dad passed away, since he was left as one of the co-trustees of the estate, he had this brilliant idea. And if you're tech savvy, it's a great idea. He started saving all the information he was collecting on his dad's estate and his dad's information and putting it on a thumb drive that he keeps in his safe at his house. So if anything happens to him, the next trustee after him won't have to go through all of the data collection and all of the double checking and all of the research he went through to try to get a handle on his dad's estate. So he's got everything on a thumb drive. Not everyone that listens to us is going to be tech savvy enough to go that route, but even something as simple as a handwritten list of accounts, contact people, and even maybe a statement to your heirs saying what you want to have happen and why you've arranged things the way you have is extremely helpful. Certainly, we've had situations where estates have been left in ways where the heirs and the kids in particular have not been at all happy with how things have been done by the parents. And the parents never sat down and explained to them why they were making those estate planning choices. And that was something touched on in the article you mentioned earlier, Jim, the one about, you know, when dad secretly amasses a fortune. That was one of his things. You know, his kids had no idea he had this money. And when they sat down to talk about the inheritance, they learned it was tied up in all kinds of situations, and some of the kids were named trustees, but others weren't. It got to be a real emotional mess for the kids.
And, you know, you don't have to be tech savvy. One of our wealthier clients and one of our longer clients we were meeting, and what they have done, as I mentioned previously, is they have the main documents and some other valuables at a bank with one child that has the access or the key to the bank vault, but the other children know. And then they also have like a plastic container, as I mentioned, where they have their estate planning documents and their most recent files of their investment statements, plus files on the properties that they own outside their home. But one thing that they did, Kathleen, and this was my suggestion because this is a sizable estate and the assets are going to be held in trust for the children because of the amount of money, was I said, you know, it would probably be a good idea that you have a family dinner. What he actually did, he did better than that. He took the whole family on a vacation, kids, everything, grandchildren, everything, and they sat down in a more leisurely atmosphere and basically said, all right, here's our estate plan. Here are the things that you need to know. And one child will be the lead person, but there's a corporate trustee that's going to come in here. But they had that meeting, so they got somewhat of an idea in terms of the size of the estate, the things that were being done in terms of life insurance policy that will be covering the estate taxes, some of the charitable bequests that will be done upon the death of the final spouse. So they had a family meeting. So everybody sort of basically, I mean, they don't know all the details. They don't know which stocks are in the account or what municipal bonds are in the portfolio. They don't know all that, but they have a pretty good idea about the size of the estate, some of the complications. We've done a number of things here to minimize estate taxes, but there was a family meeting. Everybody sort of knows, and one daughter is going to be the main contact person because this is the one daughter that lives in San Diego. The other kids live in other states. And so that was an obvious choice because she would have access to the bank accounts. She knows who the attorneys are. We're here in this town. But there's a backup plan, and basically he's got a list. Okay, when something happens to either both of us, because they do a lot of traveling, or when the last spouse passes away, here are your contact points. Here's our attorney. Here's our investment manager. Here's the estate planning attorney. This is the charitable trust. Here are the charities. So there is a list everybody knows, and here's the bank accounts. All of that is organized in this little plastic container. They keep it at their house where their one daughter will have access. So it's not going to be a guessing game. It's not going to be, you know, sort of the kids aren't going to have to play detective. And this is just one more reason why you really need to consider simplifying and organizing, and especially because most cases we come across, and if you're listening to this, you just talk to your spouse about this, your children, or even talk to your friends. You'll probably find in most cases, it's one of the spouses that makes all the financial decisions and the investment decisions.
I think that's pretty typical, Jim. And usually, frankly, we're still in an era where it's mostly the man. Although we do have some clients where in that family, the woman is making the financial choices, but really for the most part, it's the man. And just as a little footnote to what you were saying earlier about gathering documentation together, Jim, you know, I've noticed over the years, as we've met with a certain number of widows, probably one of the most common things that they're very scared about, Jim, is do I have enough money to pay my bills? They don't even know what their incoming and outgoing flow looks like as a family. And so one of the other things that it's a great thing to do for your spouse, if you're the money person, is to make a list of your sources of income, what your rough budget number looks like. So your spouse will know, okay, these are the sources of my income. This is how much I can expect from Social Security, from my investments, so that they can have peace of mind and not be so scared about, can I even make my mortgage payment this month?
You know, you bring up an excellent point where you have one spouse, let's say, that makes all the financial decisions, maybe pays the bills and does those kind of things. All of a sudden, that person is taken out of the picture. Now you have a surviving spouse that says, I have to pay the bills. What are they? You know, Well, do you have, you know, the obvious things like utilities? Could there be a car payment? Is there a mortgage payment? Housing insurance, medical insurance premiums? You really don't want to leave that spouse in that situation, because I've seen so many situations where the surviving spouse breaks down. Number one, she's dealing emotionally with the loss of her husband. So you've got to deal with that, because all of a sudden your life just changed. And then all the rules, the regulations, the filing, the reporting, the splitting of the trust.
The paperwork.
Oh, goodness. You really don't want to put a surviving spouse in that kind of situation. So do yourself a favor. For the love of your spouse, for the love of your children, get yourself organized. Simplify. Do you really want to have 7, 8 brokerage accounts, 5 places to store your bullion, or, you know, 6, 7, 8 bank accounts, stock certificates, things of that nature? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And not to mention, here's a scarier one, is what happens, Kathleen, when the main financial person that made all these decisions gets into a situation with dementia or Alzheimer's? So it's not just the fact that they can pass away. It's also that they can get inflicted with a debilitating disease that basically they're put in a situation of incapacity. Then all of a sudden now, the surviving spouse is dealing with executors, with trustees, all these kind of things that you normally don't want to deal with.
I think you're right, Jim. We've talked about this before on the show, and I think, you know, we've said it before, but I'll say it again. Truthfully, to have a good preparation, good estate planning, simplified assets is probably one of the best inheritances you can leave for your kids. There's the money inheritance, and then there's the lack of hassle inheritance. It's a huge gift to leave to your beneficiaries.
You know, we just have to acknowledge again that there are quality problems. That's basically what you're talking about here. Having an estate that's large complicates things for your heirs is not a bad thing. But I know that we also have listeners who worry about having funds to last through the end of life, much less leaving anything behind.
We talked about this a little bit last week, and we talked about a couple of ways to sort of refocus and rethink your retirement, mostly about the work side, looking at different ideas as far as how to have some sort of a supplementary income stream in retirement so that your assets can last a little bit longer and do a little bit more work for you.
Yeah, one of the ideas we think could be exciting for a lot of retirees is starting a business in retirement. Maybe you translate a hobby into an income stream, or maybe you offer, I'd love to do this, offer sailing lessons or private golf lessons. Or you love gardening, or you want to start a business improving curb appeal for homes for sale. Small businesses that start with ideas like these really, Kathleen, are the engine of our economy. So we've invited Ruben Garcia, local district director of the U.S. Small Business Administration, to Lifetime Income to talk about starting a small business. You would be surprised at the wealth of information at the Small Business Administration site that has not only how to get an SBA loan. The first time I bought a commercial building, it would not have been possible had it not been for the SBA. You can get business loans, how to create a business plan. There's seminars. There's all kinds of wealth of information that people really need to learn. If you're in a situation, you're contemplating, gee, you know what? I need to do something. Always wanted to turn this into some kind of a business. So we're going to be talking with Ruben coming up here right after this. Joining me as my guest on Lifetime Income this week is Ruben Garcia. He's District Director of the U.S. Small Business Administration, the San Diego District. You know, Ruben, we've been covering the area of retirement planning, and we're seeing today, at least with the boomers, a lot more boomers today are finding themselves in retirement either intentionally, they take their retirement, or unintentionally, they get laid off, and their financial situation isn't exactly where they thought it was going to be. So a lot of them are going to end up working. Let's talk about what is going on for this retirement generation versus the greatest generation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. One of the things that demographics data and employment trends are showing us is that 1 in 10 baby boomers cannot support their basic needs right now. And they're taking on additional things. They're 25 to 35% of baby boomers are still supporting the children that either come back or they need help, or aging parents, you know. And it's really something that we need to look at, because 50% of America's workforce is over 40 right now. And by 2020, 1 in 4 will be over 60. So we've got a generation that is now facing a situation where they don't have in retirement what they needed. 54% of American workers have saved less than $25,000, and 43% of American workers have saved less than $10,000. So it kind of gives you an idea that people just aren't ready for retirement, especially the baby boomers nowadays.
Yeah, one thing that we've seen, Ruben, over the last couple decades, I can remember, at least in my parents' generation, you know, dad went to work for a company, spent 25, 30 years, probably had a defined benefit pension plan, retired, got a Timex watch, and life was wonderful. The pension, the Social Security. That has not been the case for boomers. I think I read somewhere, Ruben, you probably know this number better than I, but a lot of boomers have had 4 or 5 jobs during their working career.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you're absolutely right. It's 5.2 jobs in their working career, which compared to our previous generation, the greatest generation, most of them had 3 jobs, and that was it. So they probably had a job before they went into the war and then came back and got another job and maybe had one other one. You know, it's totally different now. People are looking for the place where they can fit in, and sometimes if they don't find it, they're not staying around. You know, they're not going to do 20 years or 30 years with that company, as we saw with the greatest generation. And the baby boomers are more mobile. They're obviously, they feel they're more capable. And that also leads to jumping, you know, from job to job. It's amazing, because that tells us one thing, that the baby boomers aren't going to settle for just a job that'll give them a watch and give them some type of mediocre pension. But the problem is that as they jump, many times they use up their savings. And so what happens is you've got baby boomers that have used up their savings, and statistics show that 43% of American workers have saved less than $10,000. So what do you do if you've got less than $10,000? You know, there's not much you can do if you want to retire. And if you've got Social Security to depend on, most people can't live on a $2,000 check, you know, from the government. It's just rather difficult nowadays. So there's been a big change from our parents' generation to the baby boomer generation.
Yeah, I think the Wall Street Journal did a study recently that a lot of boomers, I think, citing your statistic, that they're going to end up working because a number of factors. You talked about one, the burden of, let's say, taking care of children. They may have children that have gone to college, a divorced situation, or the fact that mom and dad or the parents can't afford to make it on their own. So they've got the burden of children. They've got the burden of maybe aging parents. On top of that, we've gone through two major bear markets, not only in the stock market, but we also went through one that we haven't seen for half a century, which was real estate. So they arrive at that retirement age or close to retirement age, and they don't have the assets. So let's talk about something that has always been, I think, one of the key successes of this country was the entrepreneurship in the small business. Many boomers are finding that maybe this is a way out. In other words, they can't find employment. They can't find anything meaningful, but yet they have a skill set. Why not turn that skill set into a business?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, statistics show 25% of those over 65 are self-employed. So a quarter of those that reach retirement age continue in self-employment. They either start a business, join a business that's existing and take it over. Sometimes somebody in the family leaves them a business and they continue it. So 25% of those that are over 65 are self-employed. And many seniors are continuing to work after retirement age. We're finding that people that can stay in their jobs, they're choosing not to retire. For example, in the field that I'm in with the federal government, we're finding that people are not retiring at the age of 66, which is the new retirement age now, and they're continuing on. So it's either one, there's a need to continue to have income that is sufficient to meet their needs, or they don't want to retire because they're afraid if they do retire, they're just not going to be able to make it with what they have. So it's amazing. 40% of those currently employed are employed in less than full-time jobs. And by 2020, part-time jobs are projected to increase to 50%. So while the stats may vary, all of them indicate seniors are really not prepared to retire. Jim, that's the problem. They're really just not prepared. And like you stated, some of them have situations where kids are coming back or they're coming back to help sometimes in a situation where the parents can't make it.
Reuben, what can somebody that's thinking of starting a business, first of all, what kind of businesses are you seeing with Small Business Administration? Is it a wide range from consulting, retailing, manufacturing? Is there any trend that you guys see?
Right now, it's the service sector. So anything in service, it appears that most people feel comfortable starting a business where they're providing a service, doing some kind of service. It's probably the fastest growing field in some areas, like in San Diego and Imperial County. You know, we've got tourism is very strong. And again, the service sector is very important. We've got other sectors that are growing, but that's probably the largest sector right now, the retail service. So anybody that can start a business to help out, and some of them are good handcraft, you know, they're shoe shops, shoe repairs. Some of them are little stores where they specialize niche markets, you know, they embroider caps or they do, you know, special knitting or things that they have an expertise in, you know. But across the United States, it's a service sector. That's what's happening.
What things are available to somebody that's contemplating a small business? I know when I was trying to purchase my first office building in the downturn in the 90s, what made it possible was an SBA loan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, we back loans that are SBA loans. We back them. Federal government guarantees 75 to 85% of a loan, which makes it good for the lending institution. So wherever you go, let's say you go to your local bank and the bank you deal with, if they have an SBA lending department, they can do a loan for you that we will guarantee it. And that means that we'll pay 75 to 85% of that loan. We'll cover it as a guarantee if anything should happen. And so the lending institution is more likely to do that type of loan. But beyond that, we've created a website just for 50-plus entrepreneurs. So if somebody wanted to go on the web, they could go to sba.gov/content, C-O-N-T-E-N-T, /50, like the number 50-entrepreneurs. And that gives you a whole page on, are you nearing retirement? Are you thinking about starting a small business? What do you need to start? And we can help do a self-assessment for you. We can help you with a virtual concierge of what do you need? Do you need a business plan? Do you want to find local resources? How would you like to do a small business planner? Are you thinking of buying a franchise or do you want to franchise a business? Even healthcare resources, we've got information on that on the website. So SBA really has a lot to offer on their website. In addition to that, the San Diego District Office is in partnership with AARP, which is the American Association for Retired People. And we've held 4 seminars in various parts of the district to help older adults learn about the opportunities and challenges of owning a business. We also have resource partners, SCORE, which used to stand for Service Corps of Retired Executives. Now they not only take retired people, they take anyone. So they're now the counselors to America's small business. Here in San Diego and Imperial Valley, the Small Business Development Center Network, we've got success stories through SCORE, through SBDC Network. And we also participate in the Mature Workforce Coalition, which is sponsored in San Diego County to explore ways to build a community consensus and provide assistance to older workers. So the needs of seniors in the workplace is changing, but the SBA is helping them understand and take advantage of these changes.
Yeah, Ruben, I'm looking at your website right now, and I'm just looking at some of the tools. You have SBA Direct, get online training. You got a section on how to create a business plan, qualify for government contracts, and how to get loans. I mean, it's just a wealth of information here.
Yeah, absolutely. And if somebody goes on that website and they click on any one of those, like the SBA Small Business Planner, it will actually take you to pages where you can actually figure out how to do a planner. You know, most people don't realize that you have to have a good business plan to run a business. And it's an essential part, you know, of getting your business up and running. And so people sometimes just think, I have an idea. I'm going to put a restaurant because I'm a great cook and I'm retired now. But it takes a lot more than just being a great cook. Obviously, that helps. But, you know, we don't recommend you go into this unless you've got a plan where you set it out and you said, well, what am I going to need to start? Do I need a building? I need a restaurant that's already existing. Do I buy one? Do I franchise one? You know, what do I do? And there's a lot of options. And I think these are things that we help those entrepreneurs that are looking to do something like that to kind of go through the steps so they can be helped.
Ruben, do you have seminars that you put on or webinars that you can put on to help educate up-and-coming entrepreneurs?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, if you go into sba.gov, you know, the website that you went into, you can actually put in your zip code, you know, because it'll ask you about where you're at. And if you put in your zip code, it'll actually log in our office if you happen to be in the San Diego and Imperial County area. Now, no matter where you are across the United States, there's a small business office near you. We have 67 offices across the United States, and any one of them can assist you. But you can do it online also. You know, you can go online, kick in your zip code, and then it'll tell you, this is what's available to you. Are you looking to start a business? Do you have a business already? It'll ask you questions about, you know, where you want to go and what you want to do. If you go to the left on the menu, it'll say what we do, our people, our offices, our history, financial assistance. It tells you about if you want to be an 8A certified company, if you're a veteran, if you're a youth entrepreneur, if you want to do counseling, training, contracting, disaster assistance. We've got it all there. It's all covered.
Ruben, if you were to take this in a step-by-step process, let's say I got laid off. I've been looking around. I haven't been able to find the kind of job that I want to get, but I have an idea for starting a business. Is there sort of like a step 1, 2, 3 process they can go through when looking at your site that will help guide them?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, if you go to the website, the first thing that you'll see is you'll see the SBA.gov, and then it says, need answers, SBA helps direct you, find your small business information quickly. And it gives you a menu of things that you can choose from. Like if you're looking for how to start a 8A business, or you want to find out about hub status, you can actually learn about it, you know, and find out exactly what it takes to get to be an 8A certified business. And it's got feature stories in there that talks about true stories about planning versus black swan disaster, making government smarter, more innovative, and more efficient for America's entrepreneurs. And then there's a new thing coming up, the Affordable Care Act. It's going to be coming into play for a lot of small businesses, and so we have information on that. You just click on any one of those, create a business plan, find events, get online training, and you click on that, and it'll open up just a whole slew of pages for you that you can take a look at and then choose from. For example, if you go into online training, you click on that, and you'll find a small business learning center. And in that, it talks about veteran-owned small businesses in contracting, small business technology, simplified, 8A business development. 8A is for those that want to do government contracting. That's the number of the code. And then there's entrepreneurship for women. It just takes you to courses that you can actually take. Government Contracting 101, you just click on that, you go to the series, and you can actually take courses and learn how to do it. Anything you would want to do, including starting a business, an introduction to starting your own business happens to be one course. And things you should think about, you know, before you start a business. There's a time that you have to dedicate. There's plans that you have to prepare. And it's all explained. It's all done through online training.
Reuben, what if I've gone through your training and I've gone through creating a business plan? So I've got a good business plan. I've got the training. I know what it is I want to do. Now what I need is financing. Do you help entrepreneurs like how to apply for an SBA loan, things and going about it? Because, I mean, there is a technique and you want to make sure that you have the right information ready when you go for processing or going to a bank to ask for money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If they go to loans and grants, there's a bar right above on SBA.gov that says loans and grants. And it'll tell you, you know, what SBA offers to help small businesses grow, SBA loan programs, how to prepare your loan application. It actually shows you what you have to fill out, what you need to know, what you need to have, you know, the things that you'll be asked from your local institution. And then finding small business loans. Locally, we have 88 lending institutions and banks that are willing to help you with an SBA loan. And we have a list of them. You can just go right to anyone. And especially if you're dealing with a particular bank, you know, if your home bank is Bank of America or Wells Fargo or Chase or any one of those, they all have SBA lending departments. So you can learn about that. Now, additionally, here's something else that they may want to know. There are grants, the government grants. Now, those don't have to be paid back. They're not loans. So let's say you're starting a business that's going to help the homeless or help the hungry. You know, you may qualify for a government grant, which they can range anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000.
Wow.
So you might find that there's a government grant that helps out those that are helping the indigent or helping those that are homeless or those that are in need. And maybe there's funds available there. And there's other capital, such as venture capital. These are companies that will invest. And we tell people, you know, that probably is a good resource if you don't mind giving away, you know, a percentage of your business, because generally when venture capitalists come in, they're going to lend you good money, but they're expecting a good return. And sometimes that's asking for a percentage of the business. So those are some of the areas, you know, that they can look at.
Reuben, is there anything in particular, like going back to the previous question when I said, okay, I've gone through your programs. I have a good idea for a business. Let's just say I want to start a restaurant. I'm going to need some capital. Are there anything that can make the probability of getting a loan higher, for example, a down payment? Is it business experience? Is it the extent of preparedness in the business plan? I mean, is there anything that really stands out that guarantees a greater chance of success?
There are a number of things. And so we recommend that they come in to see a counselor. We have about 100 counselors with our SCORE chapter here in San Diego. Luckily, they're not all in at one time in my office because we couldn't handle them. But they come in, you know, and they will actually sit down with you for a couple of hours, and they will go through the process of helping you sit down with somebody that's in your specific field. So let's say you're thinking of starting that restaurant. You know, so one of our counselors happens to be Debbie Akins, who owns DZ Akins off of the Interstate 8 here in San Diego. And she's a great entrepreneur. She's a successful businesswoman. But she volunteers her time and she says, okay, you're going to start a restaurant. Let me tell you what I did and what I had to go through. And here's what got me the loan. You know, it was the fact that I already had a business. It was going. I wanted to grow it. And, you know, and she can go through personal examples of exactly what she went through and the things that she faced in the process. And so this is a great opportunity for people to get not only firsthand experience, but somebody that will actually advise them and say, you know, let me tell you something. You have a great idea. This is a unique restaurant, but you got one problem here. You know, you don't have the right cook or you don't know how to cook. And until you find somebody that can cook this kind of cuisine, you know, you need to sit and wait and have this in line. But once you find that right cook, or once you know that you can prepare these kind of meals, and once you have all this together, then we can help you. And the next step now is this. Let's put together your business plan. Let's take you before a lending institution. Let's present your plan and see if they're willing to fund it. And we can do loans anywhere from $500 to $5.5 million.
Reuben, as we close, give out your website, and can they just go to the website and just sort of explore, or is there a particular spot on the website you would recommend they start with?
Well, I would recommend they go to www.sba.gov, and they start right there. And it'll start just very simple, pick out what you want to do, what you're looking for. And then when you get into specifics, it's interactive. It'll actually ask you, what's your zip code? You know, what are you looking to do? Are you starting a business, or do you already own a business? You want to grow it? You know, it'll ask you questions that are very specific and get you to the right place.
We've been speaking with Reuben Garcia. He's District Director of the U.S. Small Business Administration. Once again, that website, Reuben, as we close?
www.sba.gov, like government.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Please come back and talk to us again.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to everyone.
Well, that concludes my interview with Reuben Garcia. And once again, if you find yourself in the situation that we've been discussing here, maybe you're looking for additional sources of income, you've had an idea of starting a business, you know, do yourself a favor, go to the website. There is just a wealth of information there, from starting your own business plan to accessing capital, seminars, training that you can attend. So there's really a lot of good people that are involved with this program. You heard Reuben mention a very successful entrepreneur here in San Diego who volunteers her time to help young budding entrepreneurs help start a business. So it's really worth your while. There's so much information out there. You know, if it wasn't for the SBA, I would have never got my first office building because we needed to expand. I wanted to get a building. You know, try walking into a bank, usually during the time, and especially in the early 90s during the S&L crisis when most banks didn't want to talk to you. But going about it, putting the right things together, the SBA made that possible. So if you find yourself in that situation, take advantage of the resources that are available to you. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you once again for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.